Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 43 of season 4 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan rom-com When Harry Met Sally, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jess Rogers, a very lapsed blogger who's going to get back on track soon and start her podcast again. Who knows? Maybe this will give her the extra jump to show her how much she misses it. Welcome back, Jess.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back. Actually, when I was looking for a headset to record this, the one that I used for, I don't know, 6 or 8 years of podcasting, I couldn't find it. And that was a big sign that I need to buy another one and get back to doing this. So thank you for the invitation.
Well, we have to thank Jay. Jay was the one who made the connection between us. So,
Yeah.
friend of the show, Jay Kluet of all the Deep Blue Sea podcast and the Con Air pod and the Shepherd of the Lamb. He's the
Yeah.
one who connected us. And so far, after 2 days, I'm glad he did. We'll see how the rest of the week goes. But as of now, I have high hopes that it will work. It'll hopefully work out much better than the two dates that Harry and Sally are about to describe.
Yeah.
Let's hope. Let's hope. Minute 43 begins with Sally instructing Harry and ends with Harry bending down to straighten the carpet. So yesterday we ended things. We left the Met. We had a few seconds in Harry's apartment. We know it's Harry's apartment because it is completely empty. I'm still shocked at the fact that Helen owned everything. Harry owns nothing. I think that actually attests to the fact that he was, what's the proper term to say for it? He just let her do whatever she wanted. She wanted to decorate the entire place with her stuff, and she basically said to him, "We don't need your stuff," and they apparently
Yeah.
didn't. I mean, did you look around at what's in the apartment, what we can see?
There's really not that much. I didn't zoom in or anything, but I was shocked at how big an apartment it is or
Yeah,
seems
that's right. And he got the
with
apartment.
nothing in it.
Right.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice apartment.
Don't know how. I mean, as a political consultant, I guess he's making nice money that he can actually afford it.
Probably. Yeah.
But no, we can see that there are two lamps. There's a recliner. There's a sofa. There is what looks like a jacket that's thrown on top of. Maybe it's like a radiator or something. It's hard to tell exactly what it's thrown on, but it's just there. But the thing that always sticks out at me here is, yeah, there's a jacket on what looks like a radiator. It's a pretty big
Yeah.
radiator also. What always throws me here, and it's very funny because I noticed it, and then when I listened to the commentary that has Rob Reiner, Nora Ephron, and Billy Crystal, Nora Ephron actually mentions it, the fact that Sally is holding a bottle of water. She said back in the
Yeah.
80s, people didn't do that. She said
Yeah.
this was one of the things that caught on about this movie, that people started walking around with bottles of water. I don't know if it really is connected to the movie itself, but looking at
Wow.
life today, 30, was it 30? 34 years after this movie came out, you see just about, if not half, if not even more than half of the people walking around are
Yeah.
carrying water bottles with them.
Yes.
Again, I don't know if it's really because of When Harry Met Sally, but it's a cool idea to think that maybe it is.
It almost places her like it out of time. Like it feels anachronistic for her to have a water bottle in that way, but maybe she just was one of the first. And you'll notice she's wearing a skirt or
Yes.
at least a skort.
Right. That's true. Because Harry told her that she looks better in skirts, so therefore she's showing up in a skirt.
Yeah.
I think that, again, that the question is she doing it to impress Harry? Is she doing it to make Harry happy, about his observation? Does Harry even notice that she's wearing a skirt?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think technically it is very much a skort. Like she is wearing shorts, but they are skirt-like.
Right. Right, it could be. I mean, but again, they established the shot, first of all, with a very long, it's a long shot, so that we can see, you know, how huge this apartment is, the room is. That's completely empty, but it'll look less empty when you put the carpet out. You know, I think that's what it is also. Now, you know, also, how would you find a carpet like that so simply? And, you know, you'd think that if he must have gotten it delivered, you know, so then you have the delivery people, you know, roll it out.
Yes.
You know, it's just,
it would only fit one way. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. It's just very funny, you know, seeing the two of them try to do this, because they're just like kicking the rug open, you know, and Sally immediately realizes that it's not the, you know, it doesn't go this way. You're supposed to have it the other direction. You know, that type
of thing. But if Sally wasn't there, I bet Harry would just leave it however he first unrolled it.
Probably. But what I love about this minute is that the two of them are busy in the apartment dealing with the carpet and dealing with other things, but they have this great quote unquote walk and talk. You know, this is pre West Wing, but they do a great job here of having the two of them have this very important conversation while they're both busy with doing something else. You know, they're busy doing something else together, but they're still busy doing something else.
Yeah. So, it's not the reason they're there.
Right.
To talk.
Right. It just happens
to be. She's come over to his house.
Right. She's come over to his house to help him with the carpet. And, you know, while they're doing that, they're going to catch up on the fact that the two of them, you know, had these horrendous dates.
Yeah. And from the descriptions, they're pretty yucky.
Yeah.
But for different reasons. Like, it's not like both. This was what I was expecting when the conversation sort of started, that they're going to one-up each other with how awful the people they're dating are.
Right.
And it isn't.
Right.
I liked that when I was watching it.
I think, you know, this movie is also pre-Seinfeld. So I think, you know, at least people of our generation are much more used to the Seinfeld conversations about dating, you know, where all they do is complain about everything, you know, about they had a date and, you know, she was a low talker and he was a high talker. And, you know, like they always had the, you know, and I mean, they had 9 seasons of the show where just about every week somebody was dating at least someone else, one other person, you know, if not more. You know, and we got
it was bad.
That's right. And we got a lot of those conversations, and that's what you were expecting. You know, here, this is pre Seinfeld, because I think Seinfeld came out in 89, so like a month or two before. You know, but they had already, you know, this movie was probably already, you know, completely filmed by the time Seinfeld, you know, debuted. But their conversation is great. So, you know, we'll go through the conversation. First of all, Sally says, see, no, it has to go this way. So she's telling him, you got to turn the carpet around, right?
Right.
And because yesterday, Harry was talking about how completely uncomfortable his date was. So Sally then says, the first date back is always the toughest, Harry. And then he looks at her and goes, you only had one date. How do you know it's not going to get worse? And then she says, how much worse can it get? Then finishing dinner, having him reaching over, pull a hair out of my head, and starts flossing with it at the table. Do you think she means this literally?
I don't know. I've always wondered.
I've always interpreted it by her basically saying the only way this could have gotten worse is if this is what he did. But when doing my research now, it sounds as if she's actually saying this happened.
Right. And while I could believe something that terrible could happen, I don't know if you could actually get away with flossing. Like, what kind of teeth would you have that you could get away with flossing with a person's hair?
Well, it depends how thick Sally's hair is. I don't know. But I guess, still. So I always thought of that as she was saying that the only thing that could have made it, that the only thing that would have been worse than what I went through is if he would have done this. But I'm starting to question that. It might be that she's saying this really did happen, you know, because it makes me curious how bad her date was, because she doesn't tell us anything except for the fact about flossing. That's it.
Yeah, that's all she says. And I can see where you're coming from, but I've always taken it that that's actually exactly what happened. But it kind of makes sense that she's being hyperbolic to say it was this bad. It could only have been worse if it was this.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I would have. That's interesting.
You know, because we're going to get into a little bit right now. Harry talks about his date out and it goes into more detail, yeah. But Sally doesn't go into detail at all. You know, and it would have been interesting to hear what it was that bothers her about this guy on the date, except for maybe the fact that he is flossing with her hair. I don't know. Not really sure.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty bad. So what do you know about dental floss?
I know nothing about it except that I'm supposed to do it a lot.
Okay. As we probably all are supposed to. It's a cord of thin filaments that's used to remove food or plaque from beneath the teeth or places that the toothbrush isn't able to reach.
Right.
Okay. How far back do you think when do you think someone invented the idea of flossing?
Ooh, and it's in what we consider its modern version?
Yes.
I don't know. Probably less than 100 years.
200 years. It was in 1819.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, it was in 1819. I was thinking we're still in the 20th century. Right. It's 200 years. 200 years. There was a dentist in New Orleans named Levi Speer Parmley who recommended running a waxen silk thread through the interstices of the teeth between their necks and arches of the gum to dislodge that irritating matter, which no brush can remove, and which is the real source of disease.
Sure.
Floss wasn't commercially available till 1882. So think about that. It was 63 years after he invented the idea that you could actually go into a store and buy one.
That seems like such an odd thing to start creating. Like, it felt like in the mid-1800s, you created things only that were like absolutely necessary or that improved your life in some way.
Correct.
Dental floss feels like almost a cosmetic type thing, even though it totally isn't. And gingivitis and all the problems that can go on with your gums and teeth are very much real, and you have to floss.
No, I floss more because something gets stuck and it's bothering me and I can't get it out. You know, that type of thing.
Ah, so maybe that was a thing.
Right, because that's what he says. The idea of, you know, something that's irritating, you know, stuff like that. In 1898, Johnson & Johnson received a patent on it to be able to use it. In the novel Ulysses, one of the characters uses dental floss.
Okay.
All right. It actually became part of both the American and Canadian dental care routines in the 1970s.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, it's much more recent that it became common.
Correct. It became, you know, part of what society wants you to do, you know, from about 50 years ago,
right.
That type of thing. You know, they have floss picks, which are basically, you know, that's what I use. I never understood how people can, you know, like take the piece of floss and wrap it around their fingers and then put their basically one hand inside their mouth in order to try to do that. So, you know, the floss picks are much easier. It's like a little piece of plastic that has the floss on there and stuff like that. Now, the floss pick was actually invented in 1888. By a man named B.T. Mason, where he wrapped a fibrous material around a toothpick and called it the combination toothpick. And that's when people started using the thing. In 1916, someone named J.P. DeLue invented the dental floss holder that was between two vertical poles in order to be able to stick that in the mouth. The Y-shaped angle dental appliance was created in 1935. And in 1963, a man named James Kirby invented a tooth cleaning device that resembles an archaic version of today's F-shaped floss pick. You know, where you have the stick and then, you know, the way that works. And then
my nieces love those. I don't know why.
Well, because they have them with little animals on them, probably. And my daughters like them
there
too.
You go. That you know,
the different shapes of different animals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And in 1972, an inventor named Richard Wells found a way to attach floss to a single pick end. And in this exact same year, another inventor named Harry Gaselli Katz came up with the idea of making a disposable dental floss toothpick.
Oh, that's what that is. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess toothpicks were sort of the thing that they'd use instead as an irritant, right?
Correct. Did you see that in movies from the 50s? You know, people are sitting in, you know, with the two. Or actually, I think you see it in Westerns also that they have something in
a
there.
A lot more,
you know,
yeah.
I don't know if it's sure. wood or something like that, but they have something there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then Harry continues with his story of how horrendous his date was. And he says, sure, we're talking dream date compared to my horror. It started out fine. She's a very nice person. And we're sitting and we're talking in this Ethiopian restaurant that she wanted to go to. And I was making jokes, you know, like, hey, I didn't know they had food in Ethiopia. This will be a quick meal. I'll order two empty plates and we can leave. And Sally starts laughing the entire time that he keeps saying that. And he just looks at me and goes, yeah, nothing from her, not even a smile. So when I was watching this and doing my research, I was thinking, okay, wait a second. This is 1989 and he's bringing up Ethiopia. Okay. Right. So based on what you said earlier, you like me are a child of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And you know, why was Ethiopia important in the 80s?
From the famine, for sure.
And what did that spawn?
The big war with just the
No, unrest. I'm talking about pop culture. I'm talking about pop culture. Sorry.
Oh. I don't know.
We are the world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was it USA for Africa? You know, 1985.
Yeah, Band-Aid and everything.
Right. Well, Band-Aid was the one that started it. And then afterwards, you know, they did USA for Africa. Michael Jackson, yep. Lionel Richie, and Quincy Jones created the album We Are the World, which it sold more than 20 million copies. And it is still the eighth best-selling physical single of all time.
Wow, that's good to know.
Yeah,
like looking at it now, like hearing the joke now, it feels a little insensitive, but in context, it 100% made sense, right? Mm-hmm. In the 80s, yeah, there was no food in Ethiopia.
That's
it
right.
It had a famine. People were starving.
Correct.
It feels a little, I don't know, insensitive.
But again, it goes back to what we were talking about before about Seinfeld. You know, I could see in Seinfeld them making a joke like this. You know, and it's
100%.
You know, it took everyone till the final episode of Seinfeld to realize that they are horrible people. You know.
True.
You know, I remember being shocked watching that final episode and saying to myself, "Wait a second. They are horrible people."
Yeah,
you know,
they are the horrible people, not all their dates.
That's right. We've laughed along with them for 9 years. And wait a second, what does it say about us? You know, they did a great job
exactly.
of twisting things there to you know, put the mirror up in front of all of us, you know, as to, to what we liked. You know, so the song We Are the World was it won 3 Grammys, 1 American Music Award, a People's Choice Award. It was critically received because of its music video. They had a VHS version of it. They had a special edition magazine. They had books, posters, shirts. All of this promotion and merchandising, how much do you think it raised? How much money do you think it raised for USA for Africa?
$25 million.
They raised $63 million, which in today is about $156 million. You know, for humanitarian aid to Africa. I mean, the idea of taking like 50 famous singers, and actually we'll go through the list in a little while. Some of them are not singers at all, you know, that are there.
No, they're not. I remember that video.
Yes. I always remember that Dan Aykroyd's there, and I never know why. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on in the background with the recording. you know, there are rumors that they got it all in one take. I mean, they did it all in one night, because think about having to coordinate getting all of these people into the same room to record. You know, you don't have that much time.
No. And I don't think you'd ever get the whole thing back together again.
Correct. They did it all in one night. They started filming at 10:30 p.m. and at 8 a.m. they were done with including all the final,
oh my gosh,
including all of the everyone's you know, solos and things like that. They just did a great job of that. You know.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, you have a whole bunch of soloists. You have, you know, Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers, James Ingram, Tina Turner, Billy Joel, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Dionne Warwick, Willie Nelson, Al Jarreau, Bruce Springsteen, Kenny Loggins, Steve Perry, Daryl Hall, Huey Lewis, Cyndi Lauper, Kim Carnes, Bob Dylan, and Ray Charles. And then you have the chorus, which always throws me off. You have Dan Aykroyd, Harry Belafonte, Lindsey Buckingham, Mario Cipollina from Huey Lewis and the News, Johnny Cola from Huey Lewis and the News, or Sheila E., Bob Geldof. Then you have three more members of Huey Lewis and the News, Bill Gibson, Chris Hayes, and Sean Hopper. Then you have five Jacksons. You have Jackie Jackson, Latoya, Marlon, Randy, and Tito. Then you have Waylon Jennings. Bette Midler is there.
Wow.
She
didn't get a lyric.
Yeah, seriously. You have John Oates, who also didn't get a lyric. Only Daryl Hall got it. Jeffrey Osborne, Anita Pointer. Then you have the three Pointer sisters, Anita, June, and Ruth, the Pointer sisters. Smokey Robinson.
Right.
So, I mean, that's just like an amazing list that today I don't think anyone could even come close to getting that many people to agree, or that many people of that stature to agree to work together for free for one night. You know, that's just amazing.
Amazing. I mean, it's insane that they were able to put it together, and then they kind of even have done it again, right? Didn't they do it again?
Yes.
So, more recently.
Right. But first of all, we'll go through the Grammys. At the Grammy Awards, okay, they won Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Pop Performance by a Duo or a Group, Best Music Video. At the 1985 MTV Video Music Awards, it collected Best Group Video and Viewer's Choice. The People's Choice Awards, they got Favorite New Song. The American Music Awards named We Are the World the Song of the Year, and they honored all the organizers with a special award. I mean, it's just amazing the stuff that they got from this whole thing. So yes, you mentioned in 2010. After an earthquake in Haiti, they redid it,
yeah,
and they did another one. The thing is, Michael Jackson died in 2009. At his funeral service, as a memorial service, they played both "We Are the World" and "Heal the World."
Oh wow!
Yeah, and it was the first time that it re-entered the U.S. charts when they released it again, right after his death, and it debuted at number 50 on Billboard's Hot Digital Songs chart. So in 2010, they had another version with completely different people. There are a whole bunch of like live versions that, right, they did and stuff like that. Even they even had a group of people that went and did it in front of Bill Clinton, you know, in the 90s, you know, when he was president.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, it's just, yeah, really.
That's crazy.
It's just very, very, it's crazy, but cool at the same time. You know, yeah.
So cool.
And then, you know, The irony of you know, Harry making all of these jokes and Sally is laughing at the jokes right now, that, you know, that, mm-hmm, also says something about, you know, that, you know, we talked yesterday a little bit about you know, whether Sally is on the same wavelength as Harry and stuff like that. But when it comes to comedy, she must be. You know, she gets his joke.
Right. Yeah. They share a sense of humor, yeah, clearly. I think sometimes Harry is willing to accept that mostly she doesn't have a sense, right, of humor, right? She's the worst kind who think they have a sense of humor, yeah, but don't. But at the same time, she gets his, right, sense of humor. So does it matter if she has a sense of humor, right? He might just be the kind of person who likes to make people laugh, and right. she gets him. And exactly. is that enough? And I think what they're trying to show you is that, yeah, that's what right. friends are, is people who get each right. other's sense of humor.
And then he continues with his conversation and says, so I downshift into small talk, and I asked her where she went to school. And she says Michigan State. And this reminds me of Helen. All of a sudden, I'm in the middle of this mess of an anxiety attack. My heart's beating like a wild man, and I start sweating like a pig. And then Sally looks at her, at him and goes, Helen went to Michigan State? He goes, no, she went to Northwestern. But they're both Big Ten schools. I got so upset, I had to leave the restaurant. And, you know, it's just funny to see the way that he, you know, makes these type of random connections. You know, it's as if he's yeah. searching for a reason or an excuse to complain. You know, yes. that's what it is.
Yeah. And I love the way it's sort of balanced in the writing, because it couldn't possibly be just that Helen went to Michigan State, because that's too direct,
right?
Right? That's too obvious right. for the writing that would come through this. You'd have to see that weird connection in yeah. Terry's mind, that it's really, oh, right. they're both Big Ten schools. Like, maybe no one else in the world would connect that she went to Michigan State and that reminds you correct. Of Northwestern. But at the same time, it gives you a little more, and like you said before, that Helen is not really this likable person, and we don't really understand why Harry was with her. But at the same time, he clearly liked her. Like, he knew a lot about her. He had a lot of connection to who they right. were.
I mean,
they
were together for 5 years.
And
you know, they were married for 5 years.
Right. And pulling away from that, yeah, is a lot. And trying to connect to somebody is a lot of what Harry seems to be looking for. Although later we'll talk about what Harry actually right. thinks of connection.
Tomorrow.
and I love that. Yeah, tomorrow. I love that it ends this way. That he's also talking about being so upset that this is not usually what you describe as a guy being upset on a date because he's been right. reminded of his ex. It's a little more emotional than right. you'd expect from him.
Right. And because he feels that he can be so open with Sally. And that's what it yes. comes down to. And again, I love the way that sure. they're walking around the room as they're having this conversation. Sally is holding dearly onto her bottle of water, every so often taking a swig, you know, as they're yeah. talking and stuff like that. And they're like looking at the apartment, looking at how the you know, that carpet fits. Does it work? Does it not work? You know, and, mm-hmm. and like Sally looks at him right. and then looks at the carpet, and you see like she makes some faces along the way also, which is like really funny, you know, and
yeah.
And you can actually see in this minute that these are not shorts. This is a skirt. You know, something that we...
Right.
We, yeah. You can see
oh,
that
really?
This is a skirt. If you look at okay. Second 57, you can already see that she's wearing a skirt. At least that's the way it looks from this angle. It yeah, could be that there is a partition.
I agree. But if you go back... Right, where she's walking around, like seconds 5, 6, and 7, it
yes.
really looks
but
more
it's also
like
very far. It's harder to see. You know, yes, so later on when we can see her up closer, you know, then you can tell that it actually is. Yeah, it is a skirt. There's no question about that.
Well, a skirt at that time period is also pretty fashionable. So it could either
right.
easily.
No, but again, I'm reading into this that they chose that the next scene
yeah.
after Harry makes the comment, she's wearing a skirt on purpose.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and as he's talking, he like crouches down and begins to pull the carpet a little bit, and she starts to crouch down also.
Yeah,
still holding her bottle of water. You know, and that's how this minute ends. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute yeah. before we get into the script?
No, I'm good.
All right, so I must say this: we have nothing to talk about in the script because this is word for word.
Oh wow!
There's nothing else. In here, they don't have the direction on it. You know, they just have mm-hmm. their conversation. Like, we don't see the fact that you know, Harry, you know, crouches down or that the two of them are looking in any particular direction or anything like that. So, but it works.
Yeah, it does.
I think it's done really well.
Yeah.
So every Wednesday we have a segment called Harry Burns Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Billy Crystal performances. So, Jess, what have you got for us?
So Billy Crystal's big movies are just about as shallow as Meg Ryan's, which I found interesting. Like, it's not like he has 20 huge hits, or Meg Ryan has 20 huge hits. And I think of them as so iconic, so I was expecting both of them to have a lot more than looking through the list. But so When Harry Met Sally is my number five for Billy Crystal. I think he does an amazing job with it. Number four is one that I don't think got a lot of play, but I think he is amazing in it. And it's a movie called Parental Guidance.
He plays with Bette Midler, right?
With Bette Midler, and Marissa Tomei is their daughter, who's going out of town and leaves Billy Crystal and Bette Midler as the parental figures for three kids that they have to take care of. And Billy Crystal has basically just been told that his career as a baseball announcer is over. And I think he's been a minor league baseball announcer. And he's dealing with that. And he's trying to figure out how to parent the next generation. And because he seems like he was a hands-off parent. And he just tries to connect so much. And it's that offhand Billy Crystal commentary about kids and about the next generation, like, oh, in my day kind of stuff. And it's just really well done. And when his grandson does a speech from one of the biggest announcers of baseball in the history, it's so heartwarming. And watching Billy Crystal act through that is just lovely. So Parental Guidance is my number four. Can't have a list without The Princess Bride as number three, as Miracle Max. Mostly Dead comes up in my house a lot more than you'd expect.
You have Mostly Dead people in your house?
Mostly Dead of all kinds of things. Is this ready to eat? No, it's only Mostly Dead. And he's just perfect in that, right? That even though he's under all that makeup and talking to, playing off
Carol Kane.
I could remember Kane. I couldn't remember the Carol part. And just that whole scene is unforgettable. It's small, but totally unforgettable. My number two is a cheat because it's animated, but it's Monsters, Inc. And his turn as Mike Wazowski.
Not a cheat at all.
He's not physically on the screen, but it's so Billy Crystal, there's no mistaking it, right? As his partnership with John Goodman is unmistakable. It's so great. That moment where he's looking at his picture on the magazine and the label has been put over him and all you see is Sully. And he's still so excited that he's on a magazine.
Yes.
And it's just great. He's really good at it. He's happy. He's joyful and really nervous all the time in a good way.
Yes.
And then number one is City Slickers, to a huge jump ahead. That's such a good movie. I don't know if it's just that it was a movie that came out when I was old enough to go to like adult movies. That or grown up movies, I guess is a better way to describe it. Adult movies is something genre. Else.
Yeah. we'll get there next week. Movies,
but it's still kind of a family movie. So I love City Slickers. He does such a good job fighting with his friends, one of whom is in When Harry Met Sally. Bruno Kirby is there, and we get him again in City Slickers. And they just have a great dynamic. So those are my five Billy Crystal.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. That's a great list. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
They can find me on Twitter at @in_entertain, which is a throwback to my old blog, Insight into Entertainment. You probably find me at my old podcast, Real Insight, R-E-E-L, as well, where Rachel Throw and I used to go through the top grossing movie of the year and the Oscar winner of the year and compare them.
Oh, wow.
So very that's cool. Still out in the universe somewhere.
Okay. Sounds great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com, or you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, I'll have what she's having.
I'll have what she's having.
Gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. Had to be you. Thank you.